Princess Oblonskaya. She it was who had been to see Anna that morning, and they had been shopping together. Anna seemed not to notice the worried look of inquiry on Vronsky's face, but chattered gaily about what she had been buying. He saw that something unusual was taking place within her. Her eyes glittered with an expression of strained attention when her look rested on him, and in her speech and motions there was that nervous quickness and grace which, during the first period of their intimacy, had so captivated him, but which now troubled and alarmed him. The table was laid for four. They were all assembled and about to enter the little dining room when Tuskevich arrived with a message for Anna from the Princess Betsy. The princess asked to be excused for not coming to say goodbye. She was not well, but asked Anna to come and see her between 6:30 and 9. Vronsky glanced at Anna when that definite time was mentioned, which showed that care had been taken to prevent her meeting anyone there, but Anna did not seem to observe it. "I'm sorry that between 6:30 and 9 is just the time when I cannot come," she replied with a faint smile. "The princess will be very sorry."
"And I too."
"I expect you are going to hear Patti," asked Tuskevich.
"Patti, that's an idea. I would go if I could get a box."
"I could get you one," said Tuskevich.
"I should be very, very grateful if you would," replied Anna.
"But won't you stay and dine with us?"
Vronsky slightly shrugged his shoulders. He could not in the least understand what Anna was after. Why had she brought the old princess?
Why had she asked Tuskevich to stay to dinner? And, strangest of all, why was she sending him to get her a box for the opera? Was it conceivable that, in her position, she was going to the opera when Patti was to sing, and when all the subscribers, her society acquaintances, would be present?
He looked seriously at her, but she answered him with the same provocative glance of high spirits or desperation, the meaning of which he could not make out. At dinner, Anna was aggressively merry, seeming to flirt with both Tuskevich and Yashvin. After dinner, Tuskevich went to get a box, and Yashvin to have a smoke. Vronsky went with Yashvin down to his own rooms, but after sitting with him a while, ran upstairs again. Anna was already dressed in a light silk dress cut low in front and trimmed with velvet, a dress she had had made in Paris, and on her head she wore some rich white lace which outlined her face and set off her brilliant beauty to great advantage.
"You are really going to the theatre?" said he, trying not to look at her.
"Why do you ask in such a frightened way?" she said, again offended because he did not look at her. "Why should I not go?"
She appeared not to grasp the meaning of her words.
"Of course there is no reason whatever," he replied with a frown.
"That's just what I say,"
she answered, purposely ignoring the sarcasm of his tone, and calmly pulling up her long, perfumed glove.
"Anna, for heaven's sake, what has come to you?" he said, trying to recall her to her senses, as her husband once used to do.
"I don't understand your question."
"You know it is out of the question for you to go."
"Why? I am not going alone. The Princess Barbara has gone to dress and is coming with me."
He shrugged his shoulders with a bewildered and despairing look.
"But don't you know?" he began.
"I don't want to know,"
she almost screamed.
"I don't. Do I repent of what I have done? No, no, no. If it had to begin again from the beginning, I should do just the same for us. For you and me, only one thing is important. Whether we love each other. No other considerations exist. Why do we live here, separated and not seeing one another? Why can't I go? I love you, and it's all the same to me," she said, changing from French into Russian, while her eyes, as she looked at him, glittered with a light he could not understand. "So long as you have not changed toward me. Why don't you look at me?
He looked at her. He saw all the beauty of her face and of her dress, which suited her as her dresses always did. But now it was just this beauty and elegance that irritated him.
My feelings cannot change, you know that. But I beg you not to go. I entreat you, he said, again speaking French with tender entreaty in his voice, but with a cold look in his eyes. She did not hear his words, but saw the coldness of his look and replied irritably,
And I beg you will explain why I should not go.
Because it might cause you... He became confused.
I don't understand you at all. Yashvin n'est pas compromettant, and Princess Barbara is no worse than other people. Ah, here she is.
Chapter 33 Vronsky, for the first time, felt vexed and almost angry with Anna for her unwillingness to realize her position. This feeling was strengthened by the fact that he could not tell her the reason of his vexation. Had he told her frankly what he thought, he could have said, To appear dressed as you are at the theater, accompanied by the princess whom everybody knows, means not only to acknowledge your position as a fallen woman, but to throw down a challenge to society, which means to renounce it forever. But he could not say this to her.
But how can she fail to understand it? And what is happening to her? He asked himself.
He felt that his regard for her had diminished, and his consciousness of her beauty increased simultaneously. He went down, frowning, to his rooms, and taking a seat beside Yashvin, who sat with his long legs stretched out on a chair drinking brandy and seltzer, ordered the same for himself.
You were talking about Lankovsky's powerful. He is a good horse, and I advise you to buy him, said Yashvin, glancing at his comrade's gloomy countenance. It's true he has a goose rump, but his legs and head leave nothing to be desired.
I think I'll take him, replied Vronsky.
This conversation about horses interested him, but he never forgot Anna, and involuntarily listened to the steps in the corridor and glanced at the clock on the mantelpiece.
Anna Arkadyevna sent me to say that she has gone to the theatre, said a servant.
Yashvin emptied another glass of brandy into the sparkling water, drank it, and then rose, buttoning his coat.
Well, let us go, he said,
smiling slightly under cover of his big moustache, and showing by that smile that he understood the cause of Vronsky's depression but did not attach importance to it.
I'm not going, said Vronsky dismally.
Well, I have got to, I promised. Then au revoir. But why not come to the stalls? Take Krasinski's place, Yashvin added as he went out.
No, I have something to do.
With a wife, one has trouble, but with one who is not a wife, it's worse, thought Yashvin as he left the hotel.
Left alone, Vronsky got up and began pacing the room.
What is on today? The fourth abonnement. Alexander will be there with his wife, and probably mother also. That's to say, all Petersburg will be there. Now she has gone in, taken off her cloak, and come forward into the light. Tuskevich, Yashvin, the Princess Barbara.
He pictured them to himself.
And what of me? Am I afraid? Or have I put her under Tuskevich's protection?
Whichever way one looks at it, it's a stupid position.
Why does she put me in such a position? He said with a wave of his arm.
As he made this gesture, he struck the little table on which the seltzer and a decanter of brandy were standing and almost knocked it over. In trying to save it from falling, he overturned it and in his vexation kicked it and rang the bell.
If you wish to remain in my service, he said to the valet when the latter came in, remember your duties. There must be none of this sort of thing. You must clear it away.
The valet, conscious that he was not to blame, was about to defend himself, but, glancing at his master, saw by his face that there was nothing for it but to keep silence. So, stooping quickly, he knelt on the carpet and began sorting out the whole and broken glasses and bottles.
"That's not your business. Send a waiter to clear it up, and get out my dress suit."
Vronsky entered the theatre at 8:30. The performance was in full swing. The attendant, an old man, helped him off with his overcoat, recognized him, and addressing him as "Your Excellency," suggested that he need not take a ticket for his coat, but should merely call for Theodore when he wanted it. There was nobody in the brightly illuminated corridor except the attendant and two footmen, who, with their master's coats over their arms, stood listening outside a door. Through a door slightly ajar came the sounds of a muffled staccato accompaniment by the orchestra, and of a female voice rendering a musical phrase with precision. The door opened to let an attendant slip through, and the nearly completed phrase struck Vronsky's ears distinctly. The door was closed immediately, and he did not hear the end of the phrase, nor the trill after it, but knew from the thunder of applause behind the door that the trill was finished. When he entered the auditorium, brilliantly illuminated by chandeliers and bronze gas brackets, the noise still continued. On the stage, the singer, in a glitter of bare shoulders and diamonds, was bowing low and smiling as she picked up, with the help of the tenor, who held her hand, bouquets that had been clumsily flung across the footlights. She went up to a gentleman with hair shiny with pomatum and parted in the middle, who was stretching his long arms across the footlights to hand her something, and the whole audience in the stalls and in the boxes stirred, leant forward, shouted and applauded. The conductor, from his raised seat, helped to pass the bouquets and rearranged his white tie. Vronsky went to the middle of the floor, then stopped and looked around him. Today he paid less attention than ever to the familiar surroundings, the stage, the noise, and all that well-known, uninteresting, motley herd of audience in the packed theatre. In the boxes sat the same kind of ladies with the same kind of officers behind them, as usual. The same kind of people, heaven only knew who. The same gaily dressed women, uniforms, frock coats. The same dirty crowd in the gallery. And in the whole of that throng, in the boxes and front seats, some 40 real men and women. To these oases, Vronsky at once turned his attention, and immediately got into touch with them. The act had just finished when he came in, so before going to his brother's box he went up to the front row and paused beside Serpukhovsky, who was standing with his knee bent, tapping the wall of the orchestra with his heel. He had noticed Vronsky afar off and welcomed him with a smile. Vronsky had not yet seen Anna. He intentionally avoided looking her way, but from the direction in which people were looking, he knew where she was. He glanced around unobtrusively, but did not look at her. Prepared for the worst, he looked for Karenin. Luckily for him, Karenin was not in the theatre that evening. "How little of the military man is left in you," remarked Serpukhovsky. "You might be a diplomatist, an artist, or anything of that kind." "Yes, as soon as I returned home, I put on a black coat," Vronsky replied with a smile, slowly taking out his opera glasses.
"Now, in that I confess I envy you. I, when I come back from abroad and put this on again, regret my freedom," he said, touching his shoulder knot. Serpukhovskoy had long ago ceased to trouble himself about Vronsky's career, but was as fond of him as ever, and was particularly amiable to him now. "A pity you were late for the first act." Vronsky, listening with one ear, levelled his glasses first at the lower tier and then at the boxes in the dress circle, taking them all in review. Next to a lady wearing a turban and a bald old man who blinked angrily just as Vronsky's moving glass reached him, he suddenly saw Anna's proud head, strikingly beautiful, and smiling in its frame of lace. She was in the fifth box in the lower tier, some 20 paces from him. She sat in the front of the box, and, slightly turning back, was saying something to Yashvin.
the poise of her head on her fine, broad shoulders, and the gleam of restrained excitement in her eyes and her whole face, reminded him precisely of how he had seen her at the ball in Moscow. But her beauty affected him very differently now. There was no longer anything mysterious in his feelings for her, and therefore, though her beauty attracted him even more strongly, it also offended him. She was not looking his way, but he felt that she had already seen him. When Vronsky directed his glasses that way again, he noticed that the Princess Barbara was very red, and that she was laughing unnaturally and looking round incessantly at the next box, while Anna, tapping with her closed fan the red velvet edge of the box, was gazing fixedly somewhere else, not seeing, and evidently not wishing to see what was taking place in the next box. Yashvin's face wore the expression it had when he was losing at cards. He was frowning and drawing the left side of his moustache further and further into his mouth, looking askance at the adjoining box. In that box to the left were the Katasovs. Vronsky knew them, and knew that Anna had been acquainted with them. The wife, a thin little woman, was standing up in her box with her back to Anna, putting on an opera cloak which her husband was holding for her. Her face looked pale and angry, and she was speaking excitedly. Kartasov, a stout, bald-headed man, kept glancing round at Anna while trying to pacify his wife. When the wife left the box, the husband loitered behind, trying to catch Anna's eye and evidently wishing to bow to her. But Anna, with obvious intention, took no notice of him, and, turning round, was saying something to Yashvin, whose cropped head was bent toward her. Kartasov went out without bowing, and the box remained empty. Vronsky could not make out what had taken place between the Kartasovs and Anna, but he saw that it was something humiliating for Anna. He realized that from what he had seen, and especially from Anna's face, who, he knew, was summoning her utmost strength to sustain the role she had undertaken. She fully succeeded in playing that role of external tranquility. Those who did not know her and her set, and heard none of the expressions of pity, indignation, or surprise uttered by the women because she had allowed herself to appear in public and to show herself so ostentatiously in her lace headdress and in all her beauty, admired the composure and loveliness of the woman, and did not suspect that she felt as though pilloried. Knowing that something had happened, but not knowing just what, Vronsky felt painfully agitated, and, hoping to find out something, set out for his brother's box. Intentionally leaving the auditorium at the opposite side to where Anna was, he encountered the commander of his old regiment, who stood talking to two acquaintances. Vronsky heard them mention the name of Karenin, and noticed how the commander hastened to call him loudly by name with a significant glance at the others.
"Ah, Vronsky! When are you coming to see us at the regiment? We can't let you go away without a feast. You are one of our very own," said the commander.
"I shall not have time. I'm very sorry. Some other time," said Vronsky, and ran up the stairs to his brother's box. In the box was Vronsky's mother, the old countess with her iron-grey curls. Varya and the Princess Sorokina he met in the corridor outside. Having conducted the Princess Sorokina back to Vronsky's mother, Varya held out her hand to her brother-in-law and at once began to talk of the matter that interested him. He had rarely seen her so excited.
"I consider it mean and disgusting, and Madame Kartasova had no right to do it. Madame Karenina," she began. "But what is it? I don't know. Haven't you heard?"
"You know I shall be the last to hear of it."
"Is there a creature more venomous than that Kartasova?"
"But what has she done?"
"My husband told me. She insulted Madame Karenina. Her husband began conversing with her from his box, and Kartasova flew at him. It seems she said something insulting out loud and then went out."
"Count, your maman wants you," said the Princess Sorokina, looking out of the box door. "I have been expecting you all the time," said his mother with a sarcastic smile. "I never see anything of you."
Her son saw that she could not repress a smile of satisfaction.
Good evening, Maman. I was coming to you, he replied coldly.
Why don't you go faire la cour à Madame Karenine, she added, when the Princess Sorokina had stepped aside. Elle fait sensation. On oublie la pâtie pour elle.
Maman, I asked you not to speak to me about that subject, he answered, frowning.
I am saying what everyone says.
Vronsky did not reply, and after a few words addressed to the Princess Sorokina, he left the box. In the doorway, he met his brother.
Ah, Alexei, said his brother. What a shame. That woman is a fool, that's all. I was just going to see her. Let's go together.
Vronsky did not listen to him. He hurried downstairs, feeling that he must do something. He knew not what. He was disturbed both by vexation with Anna for placing herself and him in this false position, and by pity for her sufferings. He descended to the stalls and went straight to Anna's box, in front of which stood Stremov, talking to her.
There are no more tenors. Le moule en est brisé.
Vronsky bowed to her and stopped to shake hands with Stremov.
I think you got here late and missed the finest aria, said Anna to him, with a mocking glance, as it seemed to him.
I am a poor judge, he replied, looking severely at her.
Like Prince Yashvin, who considers that Patti sings too loud, she returned with a smile. Well, thank you, she said, taking with her small gloved hand a program Vronsky had picked up for her. And suddenly, at that instant, her beautiful face quivered. She rose and went to the back of the box. Noticing that during the next act her box remained empty, Vronsky left the theatre amid cries of hush from the audience, which had become quiet to listen to a cavatina. He went to his hotel. Anna had already returned. When Vronsky entered, she was still dressed as she had been at the theatre. She was sitting in the first armchair by the wall, fixedly gazing before her. She glanced at him and immediately resumed her former posture.
Anna, he said.
It's all your fault. Your fault,
she exclaimed, with tears of despair and spite in her voice, and rose.
But I entreated you not to go. I knew it would be unpleasant for you.
Unpleasant? She cried.
It was awful. However long I may live, I shall never forget it.
She said it was a disgrace to sit near me.
The words of a silly woman, he said. But why risk it? Why provoke?
I hate your calmness. You should not have driven me to it. If you loved me, Anna, is it a question of my love? Yes, if you loved me as I love you, if you suffered the anguish I do,
she replied with a frightened glance at him. He was sorry for her and yet vexed with her. He assured her of his love because he saw that that alone could pacify her now, and did not reproach her with words, though he reproached her in his heart. And those assurances of love, which to him appeared so trivial that he felt ashamed to utter them, she drank in and gradually became calm. Next day, fully reconciled, they left for the country. Part 6. Chapter 1. Dolly and her children were spending the summer with her sister Kitty at Pokrovsk. The house on her own estate was quite dilapidated, so Lievin and his wife persuaded her to spend the summer with them. Oblonsky quite approved of this arrangement. He said he greatly regretted that his duties prevented his spending the summer with his family in the country, which would have given him the greatest pleasure, and he remained in Moscow, visiting the country occasionally for a day or two at a time. Beside the Oblonskys, with all their children and their governess,
the Lievins had other visitors. The old princess, who considered it her duty to watch over her inexperienced daughter in that condition, and also Varenka, Kitty's friend from abroad, who was keeping her promise to visit her friend now that she was married. All these were relations and friends of Kitty's, and though Lievin liked them, he regretted his own, the Lievin world and order of things, which was being submerged by this influx of the Shcherbatsky element, as he put it to himself. Only one of his relatives, Sergei Ivanich, visited him that summer, and he was a man of the Koznishev type and not a Lievin, so that the Lievin spirit was quite overwhelmed. In the Lievin house, so long empty, there were now so many people that nearly every room was occupied, and the old princess was obliged almost daily to count those present before sitting down to a meal. If there chanced to be 13, she would make a grandchild sit at the side table. And Kitty, who conducted her household with great assiduity, had no little trouble to procure all the chickens, turkeys, and ducks, of which, with the visitors' and the children's summer appetites, very many were required. The whole family was assembled at dinner. Dolly's children, their governess, and Varenka were planning where they should hunt for mushrooms. Koznishev, who by his intellect and learning commanded a respect almost amounting to veneration from all the visitors, surprised everyone by joining in the conversation about mushrooms. "You must take me, too. I am very fond of looking for mushrooms," he said with a glance at Varenka. "I consider it a very good occupation." "Why, certainly, we shall be very pleased," replied Varenka with a blush. Kitty and Dolly exchanged significant looks. The intellectual and learned Koznishev's offer to go and gather mushrooms with Varenka confirmed a suspicion that had greatly occupied Kitty's mind of late. She hastened to say something to her mother so that her glance should pass unnoticed. After dinner, Koznishev sat down by the drawing-room window, continuing his conversation with his brother over a cup of coffee, and glancing now and then at the door through which the children, who were preparing to set out on the mushroom hunt, would enter. Lievin sat down on the windowsill beside his brother. Kitty stood near her husband, evidently waiting for the end of the conversation, which did not interest her, before speaking to him. "In many ways you have changed since your marriage, and for the better," said Koznishev, smiling at Kitty, and apparently not much interested in his conversation with his brother. "But you have remained true to your passion for defending the most paradoxical views." "Kate, it is not good for you to be standing," said her husband with a meaning look, moving a chair toward her. "Ah, well, there's no time now," added Koznishev as the children came running in. In advance of them all, at a sideways gallop, came Tanya in tightly pulled-up stockings, running toward Koznishev, flourishing a basket and his hat. Having boldly approached him, her beautiful eyes beaming, eyes so like her father's, she gave him his hat and made a movement as if to put it on him, her shy and gentle smile softening the boldness of the action. "Varenka is waiting," she said, carefully placing his hat on his head, when she saw from his smile that she had permission to do so. Varenka, who was wearing a yellow print dress and a white kerchief on her head, stood in the doorway. "I'm coming, Mademoiselle Varenka," said Koznishev, drinking up his coffee and pocketing his handkerchief and cigar case. "What a darling my Varenka is, eh?" Kitty said to her husband as soon as Koznishev had risen. She said it so that the latter could hear, with an evident desire that he should do so. "And how handsome, how nobly handsome." "Varenka," she exclaimed, "you will be in the wood by the mill? We will drive there." "You quite forget your condition, Kitty," said the old princess, hurrying in. "You should not shout so." Varenka, hearing Kitty's voice and her mother reprimanding her, came up with her light step. The quickness of Varenka's movements, the colour suffusing her animated face, all showed that something unusual was taking place within her. Kitty knew what that unusual thing was and watched her attentively.
She had now called Varenka only to give her a silent blessing for the important event which, according to Kitty, was to happen in the woods that day after dinner.
"Varenka, I shall be very happy if a certain thing comes to pass," she whispered, kissing her.
"And are you coming with us?" Varenka, quite confused, asked Levin, pretending not to have heard what had been said to her.
"I will come, but only as far as the threshing floor. I shall stay there."
"Oh, why should you?" said Kitty.
"I must look at the new wagons and count them," said Levin. "And where will you be?"
"On the balcony."
Chapter 2 All the women of the household were assembled on the balcony. They always liked to sit there after dinner, but today they had special business there. Besides the sewing of little shirts and the knitting of swaddling bands on which they were all engaged, today jam was being made there in a way new to Agafya Mikhailovna, without the addition of water to the fruit. Kitty was introducing this new way, which had been employed in her old home. But Agafya Mikhailovna, to whom this work had formerly been entrusted, and who considered that nothing that used to be done in the Levin house could be wrong, had, despite her directions, put water to the strawberry and the wild strawberry jam, declaring it to be indispensable. She had been detected doing this, and now the raspberry jam was being made in everyone's presence, as Agafya Mikhailovna had to be convinced that without water the jam could turn out well. Agafya Mikhailovna, with a flushed face and a grieved expression, her hair ruffled and her thin arms bared to the elbow, was shaking the preserving pan over the brazier with a circular movement, looking dismally at the raspberries and hoping with all her heart that they would harden and not get cooked through. The old princess, conscious that against her, as chief adviser in the matter of jam boiling, Agafya Mikhailovna's wrath should be directed, tried to look as if she were thinking of other things and was not interested in the raspberries. She talked of other matters, but watched the brazier out of the corner of her eye. "I always buy dress materials for the maids myself, at the sales," the princess said, continuing the conversation. "Is it not time to take the scum off, my dear?" she added, turning to Agafya Mikhailovna. "It is not at all necessary for you to do it yourself. Besides, it's hot," she said, stopping Kitty.
"I will do it," said Dolly, and she got up and began carefully sliding the spoon over the surface of the bubbling syrup, and now and then, to remove what had stuck to the spoon, she tapped it against a plate already covered with the yellowish pink scum, with blood-red streaks of syrup showing beneath it. "How they'll lick it up at tea time," she thought of the children, remembering how she herself, when a child, used to marvel that the grown-ups did not eat the scum, the nicest part.
"Steva says it's better to give them money," Dolly remarked, returning to the interesting topic of what presents it was best to give to the servants.
"But how can one give them money?" said the princess and Kitty with one voice. "They value presents so."
"Well, I, for instance, got our Matryona Semyonovna, not exactly poplin, but something of that kind last year," said the princess. "Yes, I remember she wore it on your name day. The pattern is charming, so simple and refined. I would have had one made like it myself if she hadn't had it. It is something like Varenka's, and so pretty and cheap."
"Well, I think it is ready now," said Dolly, dripping syrup from the spoon. "When it begins to string, it is ready. Boil it up a little longer, Agafya Mikhailovna."
"Oh, these flies!" cried Agafya Mikhailovna crossly.
"It will come out just the same." "Oh, how sweet he is! Don't frighten him," exclaimed Kitty unexpectedly, looking at a sparrow that had settled on the railing, turned a raspberry stalk over, and was pecking at it.
"Yes, but keep away from the brazier," said her mother.
"À propos de Varenka," said Kitty in French, which they had been talking all the time so that Agafya Mikhailovna should not understand them, "do you know, Mama, I am somehow expecting it to be settled today. You understand what I mean? How nice it would be."
"Dear me, what a skilful matchmaker," teased Dolly. "How carefully and adroitly she brings them together. Oh, come, Mama, tell me what you think about it."
"What am I to think?"
He meant Koznishev, could have made the best match in Russia any time. Now he is no longer so young, but all the same, I'm sure many would marry him, even now. She is very good-natured, but he might... Oh, but, Mama, try and understand why nothing better could be imagined either for him or for her. First of all, she is simply charming, expostulated Kitty, crooking one finger.
He certainly likes her very much, Dolly chimed in.
Secondly, his position in the world is such that neither property nor the social position of his wife matters to him at all. He only needs a good, sweet, quiet wife.
Yes, one certainly can trust her, again chimed in Dolly.
Thirdly, she must love him, and that too is... In a word, it would be splendid.
I expect when they come back from the wood it will all be settled.
I shall see it at once by their eyes. I should be so glad.
What do you think, Dolly? But don't get excited. There is no need at all for you to get excited, admonished her mother.
But I am not excited, Mama.
I think he will propose today. Ah, how strange it is when and how a man proposes. There is a sort of barrier. And suddenly, down it goes, said Dolly with a dreamy smile, recalling her past with Oblonsky.
Mama... How did Papa propose to you? Kitty suddenly inquired.
There was nothing special about it.
It was quite simple, answered the princess, but her face brightened at the memory. No, but how? You really loved him before you were allowed to talk to one another?
Kitty felt a particular charm in being able now to talk with her mother as an equal about those chief events in a woman's life.
Of course he loved me. He used to visit us in the country. But how was it decided, Mama?
I suppose you think you discovered something new.
It was just the same. It was decided by the eyes, by smiles.
How well you put it, Mama, by the eyes and by smiles. That's just it, chimed in Dolly.
What were the words he said?
What words did Constantine say to you?
He wrote with chalk. It was wonderful.
How long ago it seems, she replied. And the three women meditated silently on the same subject. Kitty was the first to break the silence. She recalled the whole of the winter preceding her marriage and her infatuation with Vronsky.
There's one thing. That old love affair of Varenka's, she said, following the natural sequence of her thoughts. I wish to tell Koznishev somehow, to prepare him. Men, all of them, are terribly jealous of our pasts.
Not all, said Dolly. You judge by your own husband. He is still tormented by the memory of Vronsky, eh? Am I not right?
You are, answered Kitty,
her eyes smiling dreamily.
But I do not know, interposed the princess, defending her maternal watchfulness over her daughter, what there is in your past to trouble him. That Vronsky courted you? Such things happen to every girl.
Oh, but we're not talking about that, said Kitty, blushing.
No, excuse me, her mother continued. And then you yourself would not let me talk it over with Vronsky, don't you remember?
Oh, Mama, said Kitty, looking pained. Nowadays one can't hold you girls in.
Your relations with him could not have gone beyond what was proper, else I should have spoken to him myself.
However, my love, it won't do for you to get agitated. Please remember that and keep calm.
I am quite calm, Mama.
How happily it turned out for Kitty that Anna came, said Dolly, and how unhappily for her.
The exact reverse, she added, struck by her thought. Then Anna was so happy and Kitty considered herself miserable. Now it's the exact reverse. I often think of her.
She's not worth thinking about. A horrid, disgusting woman without a heart, said their mother, unable to forget that Kitty had not married Vronsky but Levin.
What is the use of talking about that? Expostulated Kitty with vexation. I don't think about it and don't want to, she said, listening to her husband coming up the balcony steps. I don't want to think about it.
About what don't you want to think? He asked as he came up. No one answered, and he did not repeat the question.
I am sorry I have intruded into your women's domain, he said, glancing round at them all with a dissatisfied air, and realizing that they had been talking of something they would not have talked of in his presence. For an instant he felt that he shared Agafya Mikhailovna's dissatisfaction that the jam was boiled without water, and with the alien Shcherbatsky influence in general. He smiled, however, and went up to Kitty.
Well? He asked, looking at her with the expression with which everyone addressed her nowadays.
Quite all right, replied Kitty with a smile. And your affairs?
The wagons'll hold three times as much as peasant carts. Shall we go and fetch the children? I have ordered the trap.
What? Are you going to take Kitty in the trap? Said her mother, reproachfully.
Only at a walking pace, princess.
Levin never called the princess Maman, as sons-in-law usually do, and this displeased the princess. But though he liked and respected her very much, Levin could not address her so without violating his feeling for his dead mother. "Come with us, Mama," said Kitty. "I don't wish to see such unreasonable doings." "Well, then I'll go on foot. Walking is good for me."
And Kitty rose, went to her husband, and took his arm.
"It's good for you in moderation," said the princess.
"Well, Agafya Mikhailovna, is the jam done?" asked Levin, smiling at her and wishing to cheer her up. "Has it turned out well, the new way?"
"I suppose. We'd have thought it overdone."
"It's better so, Agafya Mikhailovna. It won't ferment, and we have no ice left in the cellar and nowhere to keep it cool," said Kitty, immediately seeing her husband's intention and addressing the old woman in the same spirit.
"On the other hand, your pickling is such that Mama says she never tasted anything like it," she added, smiling and putting the old woman's kerchief straight.
Agafya Mikhailovna looked crossly at Kitty.
"You need not comfort me, ma'am. I just look at you and him,
and then I feel happy," she said.
And that disrespectful way of speaking of her master as him seemed touching to Kitty.
"Come with us and get mushrooms. You will show us the right places."
Agafya Mikhailovna smiled and shook her head as much as to say, "Though I should like to be cross with you, I can't do it."
"Please follow my advice," said the old princess. "Cover the jam with paper soaked in rum, and then it will not get mouldy, even without ice."
Chapter 3 Kitty was particularly glad of the opportunity of being alone with her husband, for she had noticed the shadow of pain that flitted over his face, which so vividly reflected all his emotions when he came on the balcony, asked what they were talking about, and received no reply. When they started on their walk in advance of the others and had passed out of sight of the house onto the hard, dusty road, strewn with rye ears and grain, she leant more heavily on his arm and pressed it. He had already forgotten that momentarily unpleasant impression, and being alone with her experienced, now that the thought of her pregnancy never left him, a feeling still novel and joyful to him of pleasure, entirely free from sensuality, at the nearness of a beloved woman. They had nothing to say to one another, but he wanted to hear the sound of her voice, which, like her look, had been changed by her pregnancy. In her voice, as in her look, there was now a certain softness and seriousness, as of a person continually intent on one beloved task.
"You're sure you won't be tired?"
Lean more on me, he said. No. I'm so glad of a chance to be alone with you. And I own that, nice as it is to have them all, I regret our winter evenings alone together.
They were pleasant, but this is still better. Both are better, he said, pressing her hand.
Do you know what we were talking about when you came in?
About the jam?
Yes, about jam, and then about how people propose.
Ah, said Levin, listening more to the sound of her voice than to her words, thinking all the while about the road which now led through the wood, and avoiding places where she might take a false step.
And about Sergei and Varenka. Did you notice? I wanted so much, she went on. What do you think about it? And she looked into his face.
I don't know what to think, Levin replied with a smile.
Sergei seems very strange to me in that regard. I told you, yes, that he was in love with that girl who died.
It happened when I was still a child. I only knew of it from what I was told. I remember him at that time. He was wonderfully charming. But since then I have observed him with women. He is amiable, and some of them please him, but I feel that for him they are simply human beings, not women.
Yes, but now with Varenka? There seems to be something.
Perhaps there is, but one must know him. He is a peculiar, a wonderful man. He lives only a spiritual life. He is a man of too pure and lofty a nature.
What? Would that lower him?
No, but he is so used to living a purely spiritual life that he cannot reconcile himself to realities, and, after all, Varenka is a reality.
Levin had by this time become accustomed to express his thoughts boldly without troubling to put them into precise phraseology. He knew that at such loving moments as the present, his wife would understand what he meant from a mere hint, and she did understand him.
Yes, but in her there is not so much of that reality as there is in me.
I know he would never have loved me. She is all spirit.
Oh, no, he is very fond of you, and it is always such a pleasure to me when my people are fond of you.
Yes, he is kind to me, but...
But it's not like poor Nikolai. You would have loved one another, said Levin, finishing her sentence for her. Why not speak of him? He added. Sometimes I blame myself for not doing so. It will end by my forgetting him.
Oh, what a dreadful, what a charming man he was.
Yes, what were we talking about? He concluded after a pause.
You think he can't fall in love, then? Said Kitty, putting his thoughts into her own words.
Not exactly that he can't fall in love, Levin answered with a smile. But he has none of that weakness which is necessary. I always envied him, and even now, when I am so happy, I still envy him.
You envy him because he can't fall in love?
I envy him because he is better than I am, replied he, smiling. He does not live for himself. His whole life is subordinated to duty, and so he can be calm and contented.
And you? Said Kitty, with a mocking smile of loving amusement. She could not have expressed the sequence of thoughts that made her smile, but the last deduction was that her husband, in extolling his brother and depreciating himself, was not quite sincere. But she knew that this insincerity was the outcome of his affection for his brother, of a sense of shame at his own excessive happiness, and especially of that desire to improve which never left him. She loved this in him, and therefore smiled. And you? What are you dissatisfied with? She said with the same smile. Her disbelief in his dissatisfaction with himself was pleasant, and unconsciously he challenged her to give reasons for her disbelief.
I am happy, but dissatisfied with myself, he answered.
How can you be dissatisfied if you are happy?
I mean, how shall I put it? In my heart, I wish for nothing more, except that you shouldn't stumble.
Oh, dear, how can you jump so? He said, interrupting the conversation to rebuke her for making too quick a movement while stepping over a branch that lay across the path.
But when I examine myself and compare myself with others, especially with my brother, I feel how bad I am.
In what way? Asked she, still smiling. Don't you do anything for others? What about your small holdings, your farming, and your book?
No, I feel it now more than ever. And it is your fault, he answered, pressing her arm, that it's not the right thing. I do it, but it is superficial. If I could love all that work as I love you, but of late I have been doing it like a task set me.
Well, then, what do you say to Papa? Asked Kitty. Is he bad, too, because he does nothing for the common good?
He? Oh, no. But one must have your father's simplicity, clearness, and kindness, and have I got all that? I don't act, and I worry. It's you who have done it. Before you were there, and that, he said, with a glance at her figure, which she understood, I put all my strength into my work. But now I can't, and I feel ashamed. I do it just like a task that has been set me. I pretend.
Then would you now like to change places with Sergei Ivanich? Asked Kitty. Would you prefer to do that public work and love that given task as he does, and nothing more?
Of course not, replied Levin. However, I am so happy that I don't understand anything. So, you think he will propose today? He added after a pause.
I do and I don't. But I want him to, awfully. Wait, we'll see. She stooped and picked an ox-eye daisy by the roadside. There, begin. He will propose, he won't, and she handed him the flower.
He will, he won't, said Levin, pulling off the veined white petals.
No, no, exclaimed she, watching his fingers excitedly as she seized his hand to stop him. You've pulled off two at once.
Well, then we won't count this tiny one, said he, picking off a short, ill-formed petal. And here's the trap overtaking us.
Are you tired, Kitty? The princess called out. Not at all. If so, you'd better get in if the horses are quiet and go at a walking pace.
But it was not worthwhile to drive, as they had nearly reached the place. And so they all went on foot.
Chapter 4 Varenka, with the white kerchief over her black hair, surrounded by the children and good-naturedly and cheerfully busy with them, and evidently excited by the possibility of an offer of marriage from a man she liked, looked very attractive. Koznishev walked by her side and did not cease admiring her. Looking at her, he remembered all the charming things he had heard her say, and all he knew of her that was good, and he grew more and more conscious that what he felt for her was something rare, something he had felt but once before, a long, long time ago, when he was very young. His sense of pleasure at her nearness went on increasing until it reached a point where, when placing in her basket an enormous wood mushroom with a thin stem and upcurling top, he looked into her eyes, and noting the flush of joyful and frightened agitation that suffused her face, he himself became embarrassed and gave her a smile that said too much.
If it is so, I must think it over and come to a decision, and not let myself be carried away like a boy by the impulse of the moment, he told himself. Now I will go and gather mushrooms quite on my own account, or else my harvest will not be noticeable, said he,
and went away from the skirts of the wood where they were walking about, on the short, silky grass under sparsely growing old birches,
and penetrated deeper into the wood, where, among the white birch trunks, grew grey-stemmed aspens and dark hazel bushes. When he had gone some 40 paces, he stepped behind a spindle bush with pink and red earring-shaped blossoms, and paused, knowing that he could no longer be seen. Around him, everything was quiet. Only the hum of flies, like that of a swarm of bees, sounded continually high up in the birch trees beneath which he stood, and occasionally the children's voices reached him. Suddenly, from the skirts of the wood not far off, he heard Varenka's contralto voice calling to Grisha, and a smile of pleasure lit up his face. Conscious of that smile, Koznishev shook his head disapprovingly at his own state, and taking out a cigar, began to light it. He was long unable to strike a match against the bark of a birch. The delicate white outer bark adhered to the phosphorus, and the light went out. At last, one match did burn up, and the scented smoke of the cigar, like a broad swaying sheet definitely outlined, moved forwards and upwards over the bush under the overhanging branches of the birch tree. Watching the sheet of smoke, he went on slowly, meditating on his condition of mind. "Why not?" he thought. "If it were just a sudden impulse or passion, if I only felt this attraction, this mutual attraction, it is mutual, but felt that it was contrary to the whole tenor of my life, and that by giving way to it I should be false to my vocation and duty. But it is nothing of the kind. The one thing I can find against it is that when I lost Marie, I told myself that I would remain true to her memory. That is the only thing I can say against my feeling." "That is important," thought Koznishev, conscious nevertheless that this consideration could not have any importance for him personally, although in the eyes of others it might spoil his poetic role. "But apart from that, however much I searched, I could find nothing to say against my feeling. If I had chosen by reason alone, I could find nothing better." He recalled the women and girls he had known, but try as he would, he could not recall one who united in herself to such a degree all, literally all, the qualities which he, thinking the matter over in cold blood, would desire in a wife. She had all the charm and freshness of youth, but was no longer a child, and if she loved him consciously as a woman ought to love. That was one favourable consideration. The second one was, she was not only far from worldly, but evidently felt a repulsion from the world. Yet she knew the world, and had all the ways of a woman of good society, without which a life companion would be unthinkable for him. The third was, she was religious. Not irresponsibly religious and kind-hearted like a child, like Kitty, for instance, but her life was based on religious convictions. Even down to small details, Koznishev found in her all that he desired in a wife. She was poor and solitary so that she would not bring into her husband's house a crowd of relations and their influence, as he saw Kitty doing. She would be indebted to her husband for everything, which was a thing he had always desired in his future family life. And this girl, uniting all these qualities, loved him. He was modest, but could not help being aware of this. And he loved her. One of the opposite arguments was his age. But he came of a long-lived race, he had not a single grey hair, no one thought he was 40, and he remembered that Varenka had said it was only in Russia that men of 50 considered themselves old, and that in France a man of 50 considered himself dans la force de l'âge, while one of 40 was un jeune homme. And what was the use of counting by years, when he felt as young at heart as he had been 20 years ago? Was it not youth that he was experiencing now, when coming out again on the other side of the wood he saw, in the bright, slanting sunbeams,
the graceful form of Varenka in her yellow dress and with a basket on her arm, stepping lightly past the trunk of an old birch, and when the impression of Varenka merged into one with the view that had so struck him with its beauty, the view of the field of ripening oats bathed in the slanting sunbeams, and the old forest beyond, flecked with yellow, fading away into the bluish distance. His heart leapt with joy. His feelings carried him away. He felt that the matter was decided. Varenka, who had bent to pick a mushroom, rose buoyantly and glanced round. Throwing away his cigar, Koznishev went toward her with resolute steps. Chapter 5. Mademoiselle Varenka, when very young I formed my ideal of the woman I should love and whom I should be happy to call my wife. I have lived many years, and now in you for the first time I have met what I was in search of. I love you, and offer you my hand. This was what Koznishev said to himself when he was already within 10 steps of Varenka. Kneeling and with outstretched arms defending some mushrooms from Grisha, she was calling little Masha. "Come along, little ones, there are a lot here," she cried in her delightful, mellow voice. On seeing Koznishev approaching, she did not move, yet everything told him that she felt his approach and was glad of it. "Well, have you found anything?" she asked from beneath her white kerchief, turning her handsome face toward him with a gentle smile. "Not one," said Koznishev. "And you?" She did not reply, being busy with the children who surrounded her. "There's another, near the branch," she said, pointing to a small mushroom cut across its firm pinkish crown by a dry blade of grass from beneath which it had sprung up. Varenka rose when Masha had picked the mushroom, breaking it into 2 white pieces. "It reminds me of my childhood," she added, moving away from the children with Koznishev. They went a few paces in silence. Varenka saw that he wanted to speak, and guessing the subject, she grew faint with joy and fear. They had gone far enough not to be overheard, but he still had not begun. It would have been better for Varenka to remain silent. It would have been easier after a silence to say what they wished to say than after talking about mushrooms. Yet against her will, and as if by accident, she said, "So you have not found anything? But of course, deep in the wood there are always fewer." Koznishev sighed and did not speak. He was vexed that she had spoken about mushrooms. He wished to bring her back to her first remark about her childhood, but without wishing to, after a pause, he replied to her last words. "I have only heard that the white boletti grow chiefly on the outskirts, but I can't even tell which are the white ones." A few more minutes passed. They had gone still further from the children and were quite alone. Varenka's heart beat so that she seemed to hear it, and she felt herself growing red and then pale and red again. To be the wife of a man like Koznishev after her difficult life with Madame Stahl seemed to her the height of bliss. Besides, she was almost sure she loved him, and now, in a moment, it must be decided. She was frightened. Frightened of what he might or might not say. He must make his declaration now or never. Koznishev also felt this. Everything, Varenka's look, her blush, her downcast eyes, betrayed painful expectation. He saw it and was sorry for her. He even felt that to say nothing now would be to offend her. His mind went rapidly over all the arguments in favor of his decision. He repeated to himself the words with which he had intended to propose, but instead of those words, some unexpected thought caused him to say, "What difference is there between the white boletti and the birch tree variety?" Varenka's lips trembled with emotion when she replied, "There is hardly any difference in the tops, but only in the stems." And as soon as those words were spoken, both he and she understood that all was over, and that what ought to have been said would not be said, and their excitement, having reached its climax, began to subside. The stem of the birch tree, Boletus, reminds one of a dark man's beard, 2 days old, remarked Koznishev calmly. Yes, that's true, answered Varenka with a smile, and involuntarily the direction of their stroll changed. They began to return to the children. Varenka felt pained and ashamed, but at the same time she experienced a sense of relief. Koznishev, when he got home and went again over all his reasons, came to the conclusion that at first he had judged wrongly. He could not be unfaithful to Marie's memory.
"Gently! Gently, children!" shouted Levin, almost angrily, stepping in front of his wife to shield her when the crowd of children came rushing at them with shrieks of delight.
Behind the children, Koznishev and Varenka came out of the wood. Kitty had no need to question Varenka. From the calm and rather shame-faced look on both faces, she knew that her plan had not been realized.
"Well?" inquired her husband on their way home.
"Won't bite," answered Kitty with a smile and manner of speaking like her father, which Levin often observed in her with pleasure.
"Won't bite? How do you mean?"
"Like this," she said, taking her husband's hand, raising it to her mouth and slightly touching it with her closed lips, as one kisses the bishop's hand.
"Who won't bite?"
said he, laughing. "Neither. And it should have been like this."
"Mind, here are some peasants coming."
"They didn't see." Chapter 6 During the children's tea, the grown-ups sat on the balcony and talked as if nothing had happened, though they all, especially Koznishev and Varenka, knew very well that something had happened, which, though negative, was highly important. They both experienced what is felt by a pupil who has failed in an examination and has to remain in the same class or be finally expelled from the school. Everyone talked with peculiar animation about extraneous topics. Levin and Kitty felt particularly happy and in love with one another that evening. Their happiness in their love involved an unpleasant reflection on those who desired but had failed to secure the same happiness and made them feel ashamed.
"Take my word for it, Alexander won't come," said the old princess.
They were expecting Oblonsky by the evening train, and the old prince had written that he would perhaps accompany him.
"And I know why," continued the princess. "He says young married folk should be left to themselves for a while."
"Yes, Papa has really abandoned us," said Kitty. "We have not seen him."
"And are we young married folk? Why, we are such old ones now."
"Only, if he doesn't come,
I too shall say goodbye to you children," said the princess with a sorrowful sigh.
"Oh, what an idea, Mama," rejoined both her daughters. "Just consider him. Why, at present—"
And suddenly the old princess's voice unexpectedly quavered. Her daughters said no more and glanced at one another. "Mama always finds something sad," this glance seemed to say. They did not know that